some sort of an AI machine, a lot better than most AI stuff that I've seen, that continually turns out books that I really like. 10 years ago, there was Applied Cryptography, second edition, around 7 or 8 years ago. More recently, there was Secrets and Lies in 2000. And last autumn, Beyond Fear, which looks like this, and there's a flyer around, and buy it. I said in login, a must buy and a must read. And all of you know that if I say that, it means you're required to do this. To register for another Usenix conference, you'll have to show evidence that you have made that purchase. Beyond Fear really is a very good book. And Bruce, moreover, is the author of Blowfish and Two Fish, and he's what I'll refer to as the perpetrator of Cryptogram. Cryptogram's an electronic newsletter, and it's free, and it's quite brilliant. And if you want to go to, oh God, is it your site? Yeah, Schneier.com. You can actually do all the registration stuff for it. But if you're really into security, as opposed to making sure that someone doesn't steal your floppy disk, I recommend that you do subscribe to Cryptogram. So now that I've done all of Bruce's commercial, we can leave him to actually both entertain and enlighten us. Thank you, and here we are, Bruce Schneier.
Hi, I'm Bruce Schneier, and it's been 186 days since I've used PowerPoint. Actually, it's been a nice experiment. This is really this year I've decided to drop PowerPoint, and the results are interesting. I get a lot more people in feedbacks after talks saying unprepared. So I just want to let people know that the talk really does exist. It just doesn't exist on there. And sort of to answer the how do you write so many books questions, it's not an AI, it's airplane rides. You know, since they started putting power plugs in American Airlines seats, I just don't have to stop, which is kind of nice. So thanks for having me. I you know, I like coming to Usenix. I like addressing this audience. And I think we live in an interesting time for security. I call this the silly security season. But there's a sort of a lot of stuff going on. I mean, not only in the computer world, but in on the national stage and locally and in our lives, having to do with security. And more we're asked to really make decisions and trade-offs and think about security. And my latest book, I tried to write about security in general, really about the philosophy of security. Not about a particular domain, but about how to conceptualize the issues in general. And that's what I want to talk about here. I mean, it's sort of a piece of things that appear in the book and then other things that I've thought and written about since then. And the talk lasts an hour. I'll leave a bunch of time for questions, because I know you guys always like questions. And we'll see how it goes. So sort of the 10-second version of the talk, security is always a trade-off. Right? This is important. Whether you're an engineer writing a computer program or you're designing a security system for an airport, security is a trade-off. There's no such thing as absolute security. And any security you get requires giving up something. You know, the obvious thing is money. And computer systems is often performance and features. You know, you walk around your world, and we're often giving up convenience, maybe freedoms, maybe anonymity. So you're always giving up something in order to get something. And the more you give up, you know, obviously the more you could get. Right. In the months after 9/11, a reporter asked me, how can we stop this from ever happening again? Interesting question. I said, well, that's easy. Just ground all the aircraft. Now, on the surface, that's a ridiculous trade-off. We never would stop all of the commercial aviation in order to prevent terrorism. But if you think about the hours and days after 9/11, we did exactly that. Right? It was a very extreme time. We didn't know. We had no idea of the magnitude of the attacks, of the threat. So an extreme trade-off seemed like a reasonable thing to do. And we did it. And we make all those sorts of trade-offs, you know, it's every day in our lives. Right? When I was growing up, I had relatives that lived in a gated community. This was a community of houses that had walls and a guard. Right? They gave up some freedom of movement for some additional security. And they made that trade-off willingly. So the metaphor I like to use when thinking about this is that we are all security consumers. We're all consumers of security. And the question to ask, right, as a consumer is not, does this thing make us more secure, but is the trade-off worth it? Is this security we're getting a good use of our security dollar, of the things we're giving up? Right? You know, we spend however many billions of dollars in the U.S. fighting terrorism. Are we getting that many billions of dollars of terrorism protection? Right? If we are, great. If we're not, we're wasting money. Right? We could better spend that money elsewhere. As consumers, we're getting ripped off. Now, I mean, an easy example is a bulletproof vest. Right? Bulletproof vests, you know, they work, right? Bulletproof vests do stop bullets, but none of us in this room are wearing one. Right? It's not because they're not effective, and that's not because there are technological problems with bulletproof vests. It's because for most of us, it's not worth it. It's not worth the money. It's not worth, giving up the fashion savvy. I mean, it's not worth the trade-off. So we don't wear bulletproof vests. And I believe that all security trade-offs, right, national network, you know, should be looked at along the same lines. Right? Is countermeasure X worth it? So, wandering around your world, I maintain you make this trade-off all the time. Right? Whether you decide whether or not to lock your car, whether last night you decided whether to double lock your hotel room door, you made a security trade-off. Is the amount of security I'm getting worth getting up out of my bed and locking that door? Right? You know, this morning I ate something at Starbucks. I decided that eating something was a good trade-off for the risk of, dying of food poisoning. I mean, we make these trade-offs naturally. When we walk down the street, are we going to, if we see some dangerous-looking people, do we cross the street? Right? We're making a security trade-off. And most of this is common sense. Right? The interesting thing to take away here is that this is all basic common sense. People have a natural intuition about trade-offs. And even more basic, everything has a natural intuition about trade-offs. It's part of being alive. I mean, if you think about the Darwinian model of evolution, surviving to reproduce is what's key. So having a natural intuition about security trade-offs that keeps you alive is something that we as a successful species have in spades. I mean, think of a rabbit. I mean, think of a rabbit in a field eating grass, and he sees a fox. He is going to make a security trade-off, whether he should stay or flee. And rabbits that successfully make that trade-off live to reproduce, and rabbits that don't either get eaten or starve. I mean, that's a perfect example of a security trade-off. Now, rabbits will have an ingrained intuition about it. You know, we as humans rely a little more on intellectual analysis. But it's really the same thing. Okay, so here's the fundamental security paradox of the human species. As a successful species on the planet, we are and should be very, very good at making security trade-offs. On the other hand, we are hopelessly miserable at it. Right? We make bad security trade-offs all the time. We worry about the wrong things. We make extreme trade-offs when they're not warranted and ignore security problems when they are warranted. Now, how do we get it so wrong? And it's an interesting question. I spent about a couple of chapters in my book talking about it, although I don't conceptualize it in precisely that way. and I'll sort of leave away some of it here. In my book, I have a five-step process to go through in making these security trade-offs. The point of the process, and I use many examples of the process for personal and all the way up to national security, is to make the intuitive process explicit. The idea is that if we both have an intuition about something, it's very hard to argue because we're not reasoning. We have a feeling. But if I can force us to slow down and take that intuitive process and break it down into several steps, we can look at our answers at the different steps, and we have a basis for argument and a basis for discussion. And I think that's important. I mean, the goal is to have a rational discussion rather than an emotional one. So once you start doing that with different security trade-offs, you learn a couple of things. One, security trade-offs are subjective. Right? There is no single correct answer to, is it worth it? Because a lot of the things we're trading off have subjective value. There are things like convenience and things like privacy. It's not always dollars. An example would be a home alarm system. Some of us have it and some of us don't. Now, whether we do or do not might depend on, you know, where we live, how much cool stuff we have, you know, do we live alone or do we have a family? Right? There's a bunch of considerations that'll go into that trade-off decision, but there are also much more subjective ones. How much inconvenience are you willing to live with? I mean, you know, turning an alarm on and off all the time is in some sense annoying. Are you willing to do that every day? You know, how much risk are you willing to live with? And those are much more subjective. And then some of you will have an alarm system, some of you won't. Right? There's no right or wrong answer. Half of you aren't wrong. You're just evaluating the trade-offs differently. There's also a difference between actual risk and perceived risk. You know, we saw this a lot in the months after 9/11. You see it even now with airline travel. The notion of risk is very essential to this trade-off because the risk is what you're reducing. Right? The risk is what caused you to make the trade-off. And most of us have an intuition about risk, but in modern society, it rarely matches reality. And I have two main culprits. I've been thinking a lot about this. In my book, I have sort of six different ways that people mess with risk perception. And it's things like we exaggerate spectacular and rare risks, but downplay common and pedestrian risks. Right? That's very frequent. The unknown is more risky than the known. Right? Involuntary risks are perceived as more dangerous than voluntary risks. You know, if we feel we could control it, we worry about it less. You sort of see that a lot in network security, where people believe they can control a lot of the risks they can't, and sort of downplay them because of that. And you sort of see that go the other way in things like terrorism, where because it's by definition random, it's perceived as much riskier than it is, because that lack of control. It's why people are afraid to fly and not afraid to drive, because they feel when driving, they're in control, even though that's much more risky. So I have two main culprits for why in modern society we get this wrong so much. And one of them is technology, another is the media. Let's do the media first. Our perception of risk is based on our input. If you sort of think about a species, we learn about risk by going through the world, and we learn things like, you know, fire is hot and bears are dangerous. But what the media does is it exaggerates certain things and downplays others. Right? If something all... What I often tell people is that if it's in the news, by definition, don't worry about it. Right? Because if it's in the news, that means it almost never happens. That's the definition of news. If it happens all the time, it's not news. But what the newspapers do, and I mean, I'm not blaming them, this is just sort of a natural effect of the process, is they replay the rare. And that makes it in our brains feel more common because we read about it a lot more. Right? The very common and dangerous risks in our society, you know, spouse abuse, don't get played as much, so they're not perceived as risky as the rare things that get played over and over again. The second culprit is technology. Technology, and again, I'm not blaming technology, it's sort of an effect we have to deal with. What technology does is it hides how things work. It obscures risks by hiding their effects. So we don't really see how something works. We might not understand the risks. Voting technology is a great example of that. I mean, so much of the mechanism is hidden from public view that people don't understand the risks. And it's very hard to convince them of them because it requires them to understand a lot about the technology. So we're living in a world more where technology, as it simplifies, also obscures, which in security can be dangerous because it prevents people from making these security trade-offs. And that's something we just have to deal with. You know, I sort of see really no obvious way around the general problem. So what makes security worth it? I mean, it's sort of the things you think about. If it's, you know, commensurate with a threat, if it doesn't cost too much, if it doesn't require us to give away too many trade-offs, if it actually does what it's supposed to do. Now, and we can run through a whole lot of examples and figure out what's worth it and what isn't. You know, I mean, taking terrorism as an example, because that's the one that's sort of in the news. You know, things that tend to be worth it, well-trained police officers, immigration officers, you know, make a lot of sense. Spending money on emergency response, right? That's a trade-off that tends to be commensurate with the threat and is worth it. I mean, there are a lot of things that aren't worth it, and I can do a whole talk on them, which I'm not, right? I mean, things like national ID cards, fingerprinting foreigners when they come into the country. I mean, there are lots of examples of what to me seem very extreme trade-offs. You know, we're giving away a lot in money and liberties, and we're just not getting much in return. And we're seeing more and more of that in society. I mean, even today, very extreme trade-offs for not getting much in return. And it's a reasonable question to ask, if so many things aren't worth it, why do we have them? You know, what's going wrong that we keep, you know, in general, either accepting or having these things foisted on us, these trade-offs that aren't worth it? I mean, the people in power, you'd think, would want to deal with the threat. I mean, it would make a lot of sense that everybody wants to make these trade-offs sensibly. Yet, to me, we have a lot of nonsensical trade-offs. So it's worth stepping back and saying, why? What's going on? What's going wrong? Well, the answer, and to me it's an interesting one, is that security decisions are very often made for non-security reasons. I mean, these decisions, these trade-offs, are actually much larger than security. I mean, and to me this also explains most of what's wrong with network security. The trade-offs that are being made are often being made for non-security reasons. As a security professional, it might piss me off, but it's true. I can't stop it. Security is often part of a larger decision. I mean, a basic example. I can improve security at a bank by strip searching everybody who comes in and leaves. Right? That'll work. Right? Security will be improved. Right? The bank will also close in a week. Right? There are non-security considerations that are more important. In retail stores, most shoplifting occurs in dressing rooms. If you remove the dressing rooms, you would have a more secure store. You'd have less shoplifting. Right? But that's bad for business. So here's a store that might make a perfectly reasonable trade-off and say, we are going to accept this risk, right, these losses due to shoplifting, even though there's a perfectly reasonable security countermeasure, because the side effects, the non-security effects of that are too great. Now, in my book, I talk a lot about security theater, security countermeasures that don't do any good. My favorite example are the National Guard troops that were in the airports in the months after 9/11. I mean, if you remember them, they looked scary, but they didn't have any bullets in their guns. Now, so what are they doing there? Well, they're there for an important reason. If you remember back then, the American public was afraid to fly. So while it made no sense from a security perspective to have, you know, basically, I don't know, actors pretending to be security people in airports, it might have made a lot of sense from a sort of national economy perspective. And I couldn't tell you whether it made sense or not, but that is certainly, I think, the correct perspective to look at it. Right? The trade-offs are bigger than security. And there's also the notion of agenda. I spent a lot of time with this in my book, and I think this is very important for all of us to understand, really at every level of security, no matter where we deal with it, that there is a notion of agenda when you're dealing with security trade-offs. So let me sort of give you the litany. So any major security decision affects multiple parties. I call them players in my book. Sort of, I steal a term from game theory. Right, stakeholders is the term from economics you could use also. Each player has their own agenda in security, right, in making that trade-off. They have their own unique perspective, and they have their own unique things they're giving up versus things they're getting for the security decision. And the player who gets to make the security decision will make the one that matches his agenda. Right? I don't know how many of you live in Boston, but Boston is basically closing down for the Democratic National Convention. I was reading a flyer yesterday about how they're closing some of the major highways and different train stations. I mean, they're making extraordinary security trade-offs, which looking at make absolutely no sense. Right? I mean, they're completely ridiculous. They're not commensurate with the threat at all. So how is this happening? Well, look at it from the point of view of the agenda of the city officials. Right? They close the highway. Well, they're not inconvenienced. I mean, you guys are, but that's not them. But if they get it wrong, right? Even though it's a very small chance that they get this wrong, they think they're all going to be fired. Right? They're out of a job. They're going to be not going to be reelected. For them, it's a reasonable trade-off to make this, to put in all these security measures. Whereas for us, right, people living in the city, it seems ridiculous. And that's very important to understand. Because they get to make the trade-off, they make the one that's beneficial to them. I mean, where did you see this? I don't know if anyone remembers KAL-007, and that was a Korean plane shot down over Russia a bunch of years ago. Right, a very extreme security countermeasure for a very minor threat. The general in charge that night knew that the last time a plane penetrated Soviet airspace, the general in charge was put in jail. I believe he was executed, although I might be wrong about that. So the general who's making the trade-off, it's a different trade-off. I mean, I go to jail versus we shoot down this plane. Well, that's easy. Right? Because from his perspective, that's a reasonable trade-off. Counterfeiting is a good example. Right? This kind of things bites you in counterfeiting's countermeasures. If you think about it, it is not in your best interest to find counterfeit money in your wallet. Right? You don't want to do it. Any security countermeasure that we devise to prevent counterfeiting that involves you, that involves the public, checking for counterfeit money in their wallet will fail because we won't do it. Right, and this is why we're seeing a lot of new bills in the U.S. system. We have lots of security features. There's surprisingly little money being spent on educating us on how to detect counterfeit money. Because that education money would be wasted. Because we're just not going to play along. Because our agenda is different. We would personally lose if we found counterfeit money. Right? To me, this explains a lot of the increases in police power we've seen in the U.S. post 9/11. If you think about it, increasing police power is in the agenda of the police. Right? From their perspective, they will do a better job the more power they have. Right? From their perspective, they're honest and honorable, and they're going to do the right thing. And there's no reason to have, checks and balances, judicial review, warrants, all the things that have been lessened over the past couple of years. Now, to me, the reason we have them in the U.S. now is that more and more the police agenda is in charge. It's driving the national agenda. So you're likely to see trade-offs that benefit the police, even though they might not benefit society as a whole. Because our voices are lessened and the police voices are raised. I mean, I don't think that's good, but you know, it's an effect of the times, and it sort of shows, you know, how we deal with this. Right? Because understanding this, to me, is the first step to fixing it. Right? My goal, I sort of think of it as security utilitarianism. Right? You know, the greatest security for the greatest number for the least trade-offs. You know, sort of from a God's eye view, getting the best security we can for the least. And so that brings me to the idea of negotiation. And if the goal is to get better security, or at least better security from our perspective, we have to learn to negotiate. All of these security decisions come down to a negotiation between the players. I mean, usually there isn't one player that gets to make the decisions. I mean, there are sometimes. Right? In a family, the adults make the decisions and the kids go along with it. You know, if you're going to decide whether to get a burglar alarm system, you're probably not going to consult your seven-year-old. Right? He'll have no power in these negotiations. But, you know, as when you get into sort of more involved situations, there is a negotiation. And there are different organizations with different power levels. Right? Governments, industries, companies, different organizations, people, right? Citizens, voters, consumers, however you want to look at us. I mean, we are all different players in the negotiation. You saw this in the debate against arming pilots. And I remember seeing it very clearly. You had the pilots with one agenda, the flight attendants with another. They would say things like, oh, we don't want the pilots with the guns behind the locked door and us on the other side. You had the government that had their own agenda. You had passenger unions. You had the airlines themselves. And each was making the trade-off from their agenda. And there was this negotiation. Now, negotiation is important, but you got to remember the right time to do it. Right? You know, when you walk through airline security when you're going home from this conference is the wrong time to negotiate. And that's important. And it's interesting because many of the security decisions are made at a level that we don't have access to. I mean, yesterday, I was going to a meeting at a building in Boston, and to get a visitor's badge, they asked your name, and they were going to take your picture. And I said, no, I don't want my picture in your database. I'm here for a meeting. If they want me at the meeting, they'll either let me in or come down and talk to me. I'm not going to get my picture taken. And the woman behind the desk said, you have to. I can't let you in otherwise. Right? So here I am trying to negotiate. I mean, and it's in some ways a reasonable negotiation. The company wants me. I want to talk to the company. You know, if we have business to conduct, maybe we can go get around this security countermeasure. Right? Maybe we can negotiate this. But the woman behind the desk has no power. She's employed by the company, but she couldn't care less about my meeting. So what did she do? She went to her. Well, I went to the person I was speaking to who came down, and he's a vice president of this company. Couldn't get her to budge. Maybe that's a good thing. She went to her boss who came down, and he said, you know, it's our policy, and I can't do anything about it. You know, and I'm thinking, you know, is it possible that nobody is in charge of this policy? You know, it certainly is, right? The policy could just have a life of its own. So the security manager got his boss. So now we're five people down there, six, I guess. And still there's nothing can be done. Eventually, we find someone high enough who says, hey, there's an exception procedure. If you, the person who has invited me to this meeting, is willing to escort this visitor constantly, then he doesn't have to get his picture taken. Now, I have no idea if that was the real exception procedure, if that was made up on the spot. The woman behind the desk said, you know, you're the first person ever to question this, which I think is kind of sad. So that's interesting. I mean, and so there's an example of negotiation working, to me, in an avenue it shouldn't have. Because generally, we can negotiate Only when we step outside the system, once we're going through the system, we can't negotiate. You know, I've been asked for photo IDs at hotels upon check-in, and there's no negotiation. I mean, if you don't show the photo ID, they tell you to go away. The night clerk couldn't care less about the lost revenue. I mean, sometimes you can get in, but I have been turned away. And there have been times when it's 11 p.m. and I'm getting into the hotel and they say, we won't check you in without a photo ID, and I give them a photo ID. Because, like, you know, I don't want to negotiate. I feel kind of stuck. So you know, a lot of this illustrates what I think is the fundamental problem. We have almost no control over most of the security that affects our life. We have very, very little control day to day. You know, I can choose whether to put the chain on my hotel room door last night, but how good the lock is not under my control. You know, it's something I have to accept. Really, after it's too late to change it. Now, locks are easy. We assume most of them are halfway decent. But, you know, there's a whole lot of stuff behind the door lock and the locking, especially in hotels with the pass keys, that we know nothing about. And all we can do is accept it. Now, this doesn't mean we're powerless. But what it does mean is we need to figure out how to get more power in the negotiations. Right, and understanding when and how to negotiate. Now, to me, the best way to negotiate is to change the agendas of different players. And there are a bunch of ways to do this. And I break the mechanisms into four different ways, which I stole from Larry Lessig, who talked about in his book Code. And he doesn't use them as ways of changing agenda, but it's very, very similar. Right, you could change security agenda through government intervention. Laws, regulations, right? If there was a law that said the minimum security of a hotel room door must be X, right? That would affect the agenda of the hotel, and we would get more or less security because of that. Market forces can do that, right? If we all refuse to buy, insecure operating systems, you would see changes. And actually, and to me, the most of the improvement in Microsoft OS security comes from the threat of Linux as competition, right? Without that threat of competition, you wouldn't have that pressure to change. So market forces are a very big way of dealing with agenda. Technology does that. Right? Technology can change things. Burglar alarms became much more common when they became wireless, because the trade-off was less extreme. You didn't have to drill holes in your house. So a burglar alarm system became easier to install, so more people installed it. So there's the way of technology changing the trade-off equation. Or social norms. I mean, social norms are in some ways the most interesting way to affect trade-offs. I mean, advertising targets this. I mean, you know, we all know, I mean, that you have to buy a firewall. You don't have to actually install it properly, but you have to buy it. Right? You know, the social norm is you must have a firewall. In Japan, you see far fewer bike locks sold because far fewer bikes are stolen. Right? The security countermeasure is the social norms are different in Japan than they are in the U.S. I mean, a lot of the times we talk about computer security. We talk about education. That's changing the social norm. And I like to think of it as we have a system with four dials. And we can turn these dials in differing amounts and maybe achieve the same goals different ways. What's most effective depends a lot on the situation. And we could have disagreements in policy about which sorts of knobs make sense. I mean, you know, in my head, right, libertarians like the market forces knob. Right, there are political theories that like the government regulation knob. You know, I mean, to me, that's in the noise. And they're important discussions, but the basic idea is we want to use the knobs to change the agendas of players so they make different security trade-offs. Now, as a as a security utilitarian, what I want to do is align interests and capabilities. Right? To me, you get the best security when the player who is in charge of the security decision is also feels the effects of it. I mean, I don't like it when, let's say, the city of Boston can make these security trade-offs and we feel the brunt of it. I mean, I like it when the entity in charge of the security decision actually gets to make the trade-offs. Right? So my basic idea would be, I want to manage these risks as effectively as possible, so I want to figure out somehow what an appropriate level of risk is, and then to get the actual risk down to that appropriate level, figure out who's going to bear the cost of that delta and make them responsible. Because they're the ones who are going to make the best security trade-offs. Now, I'll give you what I think is my favorite example of it. I mean, to me, this is the best security system ever invented because it is so clever. Do you ever go into a convenience store and you see a sign on the cash register that says, "Your purchase free if you don't get a receipt"? That is a brilliant security countermeasure. And I'll explain it to you. If you are a merchant, one of the things you're worried about is employee theft. Right? Employees stealing money out of the till. And this has been a problem since forever. The first invention to try to limit employee theft was a cash register with a bell. And the bell would ring every time the drawer was opened, which would alert the store owner that the cashier has opened the drawer. You know, and that was okay as far as it went. The next big invention was the register tape. The register tape is an audit trail of the transactions. And the idea would be, and this is done today, that all transactions appear on the tape, and at the end of the day, the amount that the register tape says should be in the drawer is compared to the amount in the drawer, and the employee is liable for the rest. I don't know if he gets any overage, right? You think he should, but I actually don't know how that works. But if there is a difference, comes out of his paycheck. So now if you are an employee and you want to steal from the register, what you want is for transactions not to appear on the tape. Right? If someone runs to the counter and said, "Here's $10, I'm buying this," and you don't ring it up, you can pocket that $10. So now what the employer wants is to ensure that all transactions appear on the tape. Now, there are a couple of ways he can do this. He can stand and watch. Right? That will work. But then, you know, why is he hiring the employee? Right? I mean, the goal is that he can use his time elsewhere. So here's what he's going to do. There is someone at the register who can watch, the customer. The problem is the customer doesn't care. So what the employer is going to do is hire the customer as a temporary security guard. By putting the sign, "Your purchase free if you don't get a receipt," in front of the register, the customer is now incented to watch the employee and make sure he gets a receipt. And that works. Something very similar was done in Italy. In Italy, tax fraud is a national hobby. And merchants would underreport the things they sold all the time. So the government wanted to ensure that merchants produce receipts. So they passed a law. I mean, it's a great use of I think, against security judo. Passed a law saying that if any customer found with merchandise, I think within 60 feet of a store, or 60 meters, whatever the number is, who doesn't have a receipt can be fined. I mean, they tried passing laws saying the merchants must give receipts. They didn't work. So now they passed a law saying the customers must have receipts. And that's actually working. Because now the customer is incented to demand a receipt. The customer actually isn't party to this tax fraud. He doesn't care. He doesn't want to get fined. All right, it's that same idea. We have someone there. Let's use him in our security system. You see this kind of thing elsewhere? I mean, this notion of putting the person in the best position to mitigate the risk in charge of the risk. I mean, that was the idea behind making airport screeners government employees. Right? Before, when they were airline contractors, their agenda was get the passengers through as quickly as possible. I mean, we can argue about whether airport screening works or not, but the basic idea of making them government employees is to give them a different agenda. Right? They're judged more on security than on throughput. And lastly, we need to accept risk. I mean, this probably isn't hard for this audience, but it seems hard for a lot of people in our society. That even with all the security countermeasures we can put in place, we're not going to reduce risks to zero. I mean, risk is fundamental to being alive, and it's actually kind of fun. And we need to learn that countermeasures reduce risk, but never as far as we might want. That trade-offs very quickly reach the point of diminishing returns. You know, that basic trade-offs make sense, but as you pile more and more on, you rapidly spend a lot and get very little in return. And we need to negotiate better. We need to negotiate to deal with the risks we can't accept, and then to accept those other risks. Right? I mean, as individuals, we have very little power over most of the security that affects our lives. But in aggregate, we have a lot of power. I mean, that is what a democracy is. That in aggregate, and whether it's as voters, as consumers, right, as citizens, we have all the power. And it's important that we exercise it. And sort of my charge, if there is one, is to exercise your political and economic muscle and not to take these things lying down. Because that's how we get it wrong. You know, that's how we end up trading off more than we should. So that's my basic talk. I left a bunch of time for questions, and I see there are two microphones there and there. And you're supposed to get up now and go to the microphones. Start on that side.
One argument that's sometimes made about a lot of the security theater that one sees is that it deters or help catch not the most sophisticated attackers, but those who are less skilled or just want to cause some trouble. Are you aware of, or can you speak to, how effective it is at that, and if there's some effect that perhaps is less visible to us?
And there's a lot of truth in that. I mean, one of the reasons society works. Well, there are two reasons. Most of us are honest and honorable, and the bad guys are kind of dumb. I mean, we just don't have the criminal masterminds that we had in the cartoons growing up. And most attackers are copycats. There's a lot of doing the same thing. So countermeasures do deal with that. And you see that in, credit card fraud. It's a lot of the same thing. So countermeasures that deter what someone did previously work really well. It's one of the reasons the data mining systems actually work in preventing credit card fraud. I mean, the warning signs of a stolen credit card are pretty well known. And you can deter a lot of fraud, especially a lot of the dumb ones. And that has real effect. I worry about it more against smart attackers and attackers who by definition do different things each time. Right? There it's less effective. But, you know, dealing with the copycats, dealing with the dumb criminals, I mean, that's most of what we have to worry about in most of our security trade-offs. You know, it's the reason why you can secure your network, you know, pretty effectively by just taking the SANS top 20 and securing against them. Because most of the attacks attack the same old things everyone else did. That depends a lot on who the attacker is. There's a chapter in my book about sort of knowing your attacker. And understanding whether your attacker is a copycat or someone who's going to be clever is important to know. On that side.
As you mentioned a list of sort of early on of heuristics people use to estimate risk and how badly they work. And that's true. As an AI researcher, we sort of believe that one of the reasons for these heuristics is because the cost of reasoning is non-zero. It's very difficult to reason properly about these things. And So this is especially true in a case where your adversary is also intelligent as opposed to just nature, right? So how do people who may have trouble, you know, reasoning about these kinds of risks decide how to make these heuristic trade-offs between doing more reasoning or approximating badly?
You know, I mean, it's an education question. I mean, we're now living in society where we want our people to make a lot of sophisticated trade-offs on national policy, on personal risk. I mean, to me, education is important. I mean, one of the reasons I wrote the book is sort of to inform the national debate. And I wanted people to start thinking about these things that they were previously emoting about. You know, my way of trying to make it better is to keep trying to educate people. You know, it might be futile. You know, we might be living in a world where technology is obscuring so many things that we can't expect people to be experts in everything. You know, I don't know anything about, genetically modified foods. You know, and yet I'm expected to have an irrational opinion on that. What do? You know, I decide who I trust and trust. I outsource my opinion to someone who I trust. We do that when we go to a doctor. To me, education is important, but in the end, we have to have experts we trust, a mechanism to understand that they're trustworthy, and then another mechanism to take their recommendations and use them. You know, that's very hard, especially now, because politics are so partisan, where, you know, they're no longer experts. There are now our experts and their experts, and that makes that a much harder problem. But to me, that's the mechanism of the problem. Right? My mother will never in a million years understand the internet security, ever. Right? Twice a year I go home and I clean out her viruses and Trojans and reinstall her security software. When she calls tech support for her computer, she bought a computer, comes with a tech support contract, the first thing they say is, they make her turn off the firewall so they can diagnose. They never actually tell her to turn it on again when she's done. I'm so mad at that. Right, so she's using an expert. I mean, they might not be a great expert, but that's what she's doing. So I mean, that's the balance. Hi.
But there is this other aspect here on the education question, which is that there are things that people are capable of understanding. Like if you explain to someone rationally, well, yes. It's kind of neat that they're asking for ID at the door of this office building now, but since they have no watch list and no one in the building is qualified to notice fake ID and they never actually stop anyone, they just look at the ID and let them go by, it doesn't do anything and you could spend your security money elsewhere. People can understand that sort of thing because it's simple. It's not something about internet security. It can be conveyed to them. And a lot of what you call security theater, I prefer the phrase Potemkin security, is about things that people could understand, but the security professionals involved in the physical security people at some company or what have you feel that they need to do something, right. and so they do something. I think that if you educate people widely enough, though, a lot of people will perceive that the something they're doing isn't actually useful and get angry with them for not doing things that are perhaps more real. I'm struggling with how you can actually get people to recognize the things that are obvious even to a layman if they spend 5 seconds thinking about it.
And it is things like 5 seconds thinking about it. I mean, looking at the ID checks, and I'll ask people. And I'm not going to ask the clerk who's asking for my ID, but I'm talking to the vice president who has some power, you know, what exactly does this security measure do? And you know, they might say, I mean, how does closing the highway help prevent terrorism? Well, I said, well, it'll make it, trucks won't be able to get downtown. So there's no way for trucks to get downtown? Well, no, that's not right. They can take the streets. Okay, so what exactly, we're causing the truck bombs to get worse gas mileage as they go down. I mean, it may be a laudable goal, but I mean, and you're right. I mean, once you start, to me, it is. It's a lot of it's common sense, and it's just getting people to stop and question, what is it we're really trying to do here? you know, maybe it is futile. Maybe this, you know, I think we are living in a social time where, you know, as a privacy advocate, as a civil rights advocate, to me, I'm fighting a holding action, and that I actually don't expect to win a lot of battles right now. That I expect to sort of try to lose them better than I could otherwise, to make it not as bad as it could. I really think the political tide is turning in a certain way.
The thing I wonder about, though, is that I mean, a lot of the stuff is being... And in New York City, what was pissing me off for a long time was they were doing things, or they were announcing things like, you know, that they wouldn't allow photography, and only now, several weeks later, have they announced that they're going to do something that's actually sensible and put up signs saying, hey, if you see an abandoned briefcase or package, tell someone.
But don't photograph it.
But the thing that I wonder is, can people be convinced to get angry at the Potemkin things if you convince them when they're spending money on that, they're not spending money on the stuff that will actually save your butt?
I think it's possible. I mean, I think we can get angry that you know, $15 billion was spent on a system to fingerprint foreigners, and we're not spending almost no money on emergency response, right? Getting police and fire radios to communicate. I mean, things that actually make sense. I mean, I like things, again, looking at terrorism, spent on either end of the spectrum. Right? Stuff in the middle, defending targets, makes almost no sense because there are so many. If you actually add up the number of times more than 100 people get in a close proximity in this country, you rapidly approach a, you can't defend them all, right? Including like this room. You can't defend the targets. So money spent at the front end, intelligence and investigation, dealing with the threats, you know, whatever they are, makes sense. Money spent on the back end, emergency response, dealing with the effects of a threat, no matter what they are, makes sense. The stuff in the middle rapidly doesn't make sense. I mean, that's sort of a rule of thumb. I hope people can get angry. You know, I hope there's a very spirited debate in the current presidential election of where we're spending our money and whether we're getting security because of it, whether it's being wasted. You know, I think people can understand it if you explain in simple terms. And I think this stuff actually is simple. It just says there's not a whole lot of critical thinking, especially in the months after 9/11. We did far more reacting than thinking, which is natural. But, you know, so now's the time to step back and say, were we doing the right things? Were we being smart?
So what I hear is what we all intuitively sense. The Titanic is sinking. There are 9 people on board. They're fighting over the 3 remaining life jackets. A couple of people are rearranging the deck chairs, and some other people are down below stoking the boiler so we can really nail that goddamn iceberg. And we see the problems in that, and the morons or the uninformed or the ignorant are making these policies. How do we convince them that this is dumb, this is smart, here's what you can change, without threatening them into backing down and saying, I'm going to do it my way? How can we get them to be intelligent?
I don't know. I try to do it with rational debate, that I try to be nonpartisan.
And who do you find to talk to? The airport is the wrong place.
I don't know. You guys are still sitting here.
Yeah, but if I see something clearly wrong with airport security, who do I talk to? How do I convince them that I'm not a lunatic?
Right. And to me, the way to do that is to... Now, there are organizations that are working. I mean, EFF and EPIC are organizations working to deal with some of those dumb security things. ACLU is doing some of that work. There, you know, I try to write op-eds on the process.
But
I,
those are all loonies.
I understand.
Those people's eyes.
It's frustrating. And we might be living in an era where that stuff's not going to go away for 10 years. I mean, the only reason I'm still doing this is because I don't think I could win. If I thought I could win, I'd be so depressed, I would stop. You know, it sounds counter, but actually, I think we are fighting a holding action. That we are going to have a lot of dumb security things, a lot of things that grossly affect civil liberties. You know, and in some ways, if trading off civil liberties for security might make sense. What I really am annoyed at is giving up civil liberties and not getting security. Right? That, to me, makes no sense. If there was an actual trade-off, we could, as a society, just debate it. But most of the time, it's not. You know, maybe you're right. I share your frustration. You know, who do you talk to? mean, how do you convince a building? Look, checking photo IDs is dumb. I have a photo ID. I have a driver's license that has no photo on it. And it, I don't ask how I got it. But I actually use it all the time as a photo ID. And I almost never get stopped. So the person who said, you know, they check, all they do is they check IDs and that's simple. They don't even check the picture. They look at the name. It's really funny. You don't have to have a photo on your photo ID.
I have a partial answer to the last question. I just wanted to plug my website, stupidsecurity.com.
It's a good site. It is.
And suggest that the way these things get changed, I mean, rational debate has to be there for nerds. My argument, though, is that it is the danger of being an object of mockery that really moves this sort of thing around. People are free to reject rational argument, but they're not so free to reject, say, a really catchy song mocking their sexual prowess. And my argument is that if you can make stupid measures be really obviously stupid, then eventually they get removed. The three questions are gone, not because, you know, the cost-benefit analysis showed they'd be gone, but because airline officials and security officials were sort of questioned by Congress and didn't want to keep on looking dumb. That's my guess, anyhow.
I think it makes sense. I'll take you two more is what I'll take. So sorry, I kind of want to end on time.
One thing I can recommend is you can actually do something by sniping at the things that seem stupid.
That's sort of what he said. Yeah, I mean, right. But you're right.
Different ways
it.
Of doing that. You know, like whenever I talk with my neighbors, you know, about security stuff, like at the airport and things, I often reply the George Carlin line that airport security is just to make white folks feel comfortable. You know, and but it captures the nub of what it's there. It's about as effective as that. But the other thing you can do too is sort of explain some of the things. I mean, you've got to do it to your neighbors and stuff because they're the people that matter, I think, probably more than this audience because they're more neighbors. They explain something about, well, you can make the lines longer and inspect more, but more people die of heart attacks in this high-stress situation and so forth. You actually get more death count. Or you can even go, like even at the airport, you know, I get, you know, sometimes I'm passively resistant to some of the security measures and people will get annoyed at me and I say, well, listen, I'll follow your rules, but don't expect me to believe that it makes any difference, right? I mean, and the other thing you can do is when things stupid happen, you can be more active about it. I was talking with a lady whose daughter was taken off to get strip searched by, you know, guards without a parent present. She was like 14. And it's like, it was only because all the passengers in that area started yelling at the guards and stuff that the mother got in. And that's sort of something that everyone can do. You know, it takes a little bit of balls, but, you know, you've got to do something when you see something obviously stupid going on for obviously no security reasons.
Yeah, I think he's right. Talking to your neighbors. This is why I try to write op-eds and try to talk to people I wouldn't normally speak to and get them to sort of understand the issues. All right, last question.
So I want to get back to what you said a minute ago about how there are so many large gatherings of people, you can't defend them all. It sounded like you said if you can't defend them all, why bother defending any? And it seems like certain high-profile things like these conventions are things where they will look stupid if they don't try to take some measures and then something very obvious happens. So you can't defend against the train bombings like in Spain, but you can at least try to protect certain gatherings of certain important people who, you know, a bombing of which would make a much bigger difference.
Right. And that makes sense. I mean, there are some targets that are worth defending. I mean, you can make an argument that at airlines are a target worth more defense because the failure characteristics are so great. I mean, a bomb goes off in this room and some people die. A bomb goes off in an airplane, everybody dies. The plane, the failure is much greater. And right, and there are high-profile targets because of their symbolic nature, because of who's in the room that requires some security. And I wouldn't argue that. It's never all or nothing. It's a question of how much and then what's commensurate with the threat. So with that, thank you all for coming. Let's see. I have a bunch of book flyers I'm going to put over there. And if anyone wants me to put them on the Cryptogram mailing list, just give me an email address and I'll put you on, or you can go to the website. But thanks for coming. I always appreciate this audience. It's a fun audience. And have a good day. Have a good rest of the conference.